This is Kimberly Atkins-Store, senior opinion writer and columnist at the Boston Globe and co-host of the Politicon podcast, hashtag sisters-in-law. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the last week of June, but you'd be forgiven if you thought it was a whole month. The Supreme Court has wrapped up its term after issuing opinions that dramatically change Americans' ability to confront climate change, our constitutional rights, and faith in the High Court itself. We're going to try to make sense of it with our left, right, and center panel. I'm your guest host and your center. On the right, I'm joined by Sarah Isger. She's the host of the legal podcast Advisory Opinions from the Dispatch. She was the spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And from the left, we're joined by Christine Emba, opinion columnist and editor at The Washington Post and author of the book Rethinking Sex. Hello, Christine.
Hi, good to be here.
So first, we'll talk about the case of West Virginia versus the Environmental Protection Agency, a major decision severely limiting the tools the U.S. government can use to cut greenhouse emissions and fight climate change. The case centered on the authority of the EPA to regulate power plants. And to explain more, we are joined by our special guest this week, Jonathan H. Adler, a professor at Case Western Reserve University of Law, where he directs the Coleman P. Burke Center for Environmental Law. Jonathan, welcome.
Great to be here.
So, Jonathan, tell us why West Virginia and other states sued in this case, which started back in the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan. What was their argument here?
Well, the primary controversy is whether or not Section 111 of the Clean Air Act allows the EPA to not merely require the installation of pollution control equipment, but also to, in effect, require utilities to change the types of energy sources they use. So to force coal-burning utilities in, say, states like West Virginia and Ohio to replace some of that coal with natural gas or even solar or wind. And so West Virginia and other red states sued, arguing that the EPA does not have this authority under Section 111 of the Clean Air Act. And whether or not this is a good thing to do in terms of addressing climate change, it's the sort of policy step that Congress would have to expressly authorize.
And so what did the court decide?
Well, the court agreed with that argument. The court concluded that the Clean Air Act, Section 111, does give the EPA the authority to regulate power plants, but does not give EPA the extraordinary authority to require the sort of fuel switching or energy source switching that the EPA wanted to do. The court concluded that that sort of dramatic expansion or change in the sort of regulatory authority that the EPA was exercising presented the sort of major question that requires legislative authorization. In effect, the EPA couldn't try and pour this new wine out of the old bottle of Section 111 of the Clean Air Act.
So I like the analogy there. I was going to ask you, I mean, you and I are legal nerds as well as, I don't know if you know that I'm an admin law nerd particularly, and I don't want to geek out too much for our general audience. But explain as much as you can the fact that you mentioned the major questions doctrine. There's also something called Chevron, which guides the deference that an agency gets in its explanation by the courts, how much the courts let an agency explain themselves and act based on their own interpretations. Where does this case leave more broadly as for the American public that wants to know how much the executive branch can do through its agencies? Where does this case leave all that?
Well, I think that's an important question. I think the first principle to understand is that federal regulatory agencies only have that power that Congress gives them, that Congress has delegated to them through statutes. And so what the court basically said here is that when Congress enacts a statute like the Clean Air Act that may be very complicated and very detailed, it's one thing for the agency to fill in the details and to dot the I's and cross the T's. It's something else for the agency to repurpose a statutory provision or to take a statutory provision that's been lying around or for decades and try and tailor it or repurpose it for something new. And the court said that latter step is really contrary to the idea that agencies only have the power that Congress actually gave them. So the EPA still has its traditional air pollution control authority, What it doesn't have is the authority to dictate the mix of fuels that are used in power production. And in terms of other agencies, what it means is that if agencies are trying to address contemporary problems with old statutes, they need to be really careful. Because there will be a real question about that, whether or not that is the sort of authority that Congress gave them. And given that Congress these days does not show a lot of interest in revisiting statutes and in updating them, that can be a significant limitation, because certainly in the 21st century, we're dealing with lots of problems and lots of concerns that weren't even dreamed of back when a lot of the underlying regulatory statutes were first enacted.
Yes. And Christine, I think that last point is really an important one. I think rulings like this would mean one thing if we had a Congress that could quickly respond and state clearly exactly what authority it believes these agencies should have. But we most certainly do not. So what does that mean to you, the impact of a ruling like this?
Right. That's the clever thing about this ruling and how I think frankly, the right and the Republican Party have sort of engineered these decisions. I mean, we all know that our Congress is completely paralyzed, basically incapable of agreeing on anything, let alone sort of influential regulations. And so by saying that, you know, well, we can't do anything, we can't make decisions without congressional agreement, that simply ensures that there will be no decisions, that there will be no regulation put into place, because obviously no one's going to agree to it. So in a sense, this just means that we have agreed to not do anything for the time being and have said that that is okay and that is the precedent now.
Yeah. Sarah, what do you think? What do you think about the ruling and what the implications are for executive power?
I actually think that there is an important viewpoint that has not been out in much of the media about this, which is that actually this is the big win for climate change activists. I don't mean liberals or Democrats, but if you actually care about getting things done on climate change, you needed the EPA to lose this case. For all the reasons that others have said, but let me put it in slightly different terms. You had the Obama administration put in a rule. Then you had the Trump administration change, put in a different rule. Then you had the Biden administration put in a totally different rule. If anyone talks to a scientist about what it will take to address climate change, they will tell you doing it in four-year increments and flip-flopping around, you're never going to get there. You need long-term, sustainable plans for combating climate change. And so what the Supreme Court actually did today is a short-term, very small loss for the EPA. But what it will do politically in the ecosystem is put the pressure on Congress. As long as the executive will act, Congress doesn't need to do anything. Why would they take that political risk of doing too much, not doing enough, letting their opponent run against them from either their flank or from the center? So they do nothing because it's in their rational self-interest. Instead, by the courts getting the executive branch out of this business, you actually have a shot for climate change activists or religious liberty activists or anything else to have long-term sustainable legislation done by Congress because that political pressure can do its job.
Well, Sarah, let me push back a little bit. Is it the fact that Congress wasn't acting because the ball was in the executive's court and that took the pressure off of them? Or is it the idea that people who opposed these regulations, including the carbon energy lobby, pushed against them knowing that Congress isn't going to act because Congress is completely stagnated and gridlocked and harmed by its own internal polarization that they knew going to the court would get them the win that they wanted?
So I am making a long-term, big-picture argument. Congress didn't used to be stagnated, so you need to look at why that has happened. And you see two things that will start moving in the late 80s, early 90s that we're seeing the results of now. One is the real change in Supreme Court confirmation hearings, which is going to move a lot of that political attention to the court, because at the same time, you have the explosion of the administrative state coming out of sort of those Nixon years, Ford, Carter, 70s, where they started having all these agencies. Those agencies were putting out rules that were so similar to congressional laws that they started really taking the place of that. And so then fast forward, for instance, to the Obama administration, where he says, I want Congress to do something, but if they don't, I have a pen and a phone and I'm going to figure out a way to do it myself. Why would Congress ever then do it? All he did was tell Congress they don't need to do anything. And to be clear, this isn't just climate change. Look at immigration. Exact same thing. It's too politically dicey for Congress to take on because they know that the executive will keep trying to do things. DACA, DAPA, that took all the pressure off Congress to actually log roll, find a compromise the way that they used to. So again, really big picture, explosion of the administrative state, that meant more executive action. That meant the courts became front and center of challenging that executive action. And Congress got to sit back, put their hands behind their head and have a corona on the beach.
I see this big picture argument, but I am not confident that in the timeframe that we need to act to, you know, make a difference on climate change, Congress is somehow going to sort of wake up from their nap on the beach and say, oh yeah, actually we need to just cool down with the polarization, put down our beers and really start working together. That's the mood that we're in. I think it's far more likely, unfortunately, that our Congress continues down its currently politicized and highly polarized path. We have already gotten, I think, as a country, you know, comfortable with, well, not comfortable, but resigned to the fact that, you know, our Congress is stagnated and absent large changes, very little useful legislation is going to appear out of it.
But Christine, can I give you a counterexample?
Mm-hmm.
Guns. The executive branch, Joe Biden, said there was nothing he could do on guns. And you actually then saw a compromise by both sides in Congress to get gun legislation for the first time in decades.
Let me give Christine a minute to respond to that.
When, again, we're talking about when you say do something, there's a difference between just doing something and actually doing something substantive and meaningful. I think in the example of gun legislation, like, yes, I suppose you could say that Congress passed gun legislation for the first time in years. So technically it did something. But if you look at the gun legislation that was passed, you know, some incentives, funding for mental health care, but not very much that will actually change the climate of gun violence and access in our country, the real changes that we actually need to be made. You know, doing something can be sort of a symbolic passing of a vote or actually doing something that makes a difference. And while perhaps Congress might now be inspired to do things symbolically so that it looks like they're working in a way, which is what this gun legislation felt like to me, that doing something is still not having the real impact that we need. And I don't think that that's going to change.
Jonathan, I want to ask you as a matter of law, administrative law, it seems that this court has a much greater antipathy toward the administrative state, the ability of this sort of action through the executive branch than it did when I was in law school back in the 90s. What does that portend? What does that mean for the future of the EPA and other agencies?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that the court is more skeptical of broad delegations of power to agencies than it used to be. But I also think it's fair to say that agencies exercise that sort of authority far more often than they used to. You know, this decision is of a piece with decisions like FDA versus Brown and Williamson, in which the court had concluded that Congress had not secretly given the FDA the authority to ban cigarettes in the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and that the regulation of cigarettes was something Congress would have to separately authorize, which after that decision, Congress did. I think what it means going forward is that the era of the executive branch directing administrative agencies to create new programs to address new problems may be coming to an end, that we will return to an idea that that sort of authority has to be expressly given by Congress, and that Congress does need to take more responsibility to regularly update and reauthorize laws to address problems, because that's what we elect them to do. I do think, contrary to kind of the prevailing view, that in areas that are not overly partisan or overly tribalized or divisive, we do see Congress acting. We saw the infrastructure bill last year. We saw in 2020, Congress enacted the largest conservation funding bill in the nation's history. It didn't get a lot of attention because it didn't provoke, you know, red versus blue tensions, but it was Congress taking action to address important concerns. And I think the message to the court is that's the way our government is supposed to operate, that agencies that are not elected, that have vast reservoirs of authority, cannot be the ones taking the initiative to decide what the big policy problems are and what the solutions should be. Rather, they are the agents for the legislature, but the legislature has to be the one giving them directions and instruction.
All right. We've been talking with Jonathan Adler, law professor at Case Western Reserve University School of Law. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And I'll be back with Sarah Isger and Christine Emba to talk about the future of abortion in America. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, columnist for the Boston Globe. And on the left is Christine Emba, columnist and editor at the Washington Post. And on the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer and podcast host at the Dispatch. So now Americans have had about a week to process the Supreme Court's monumental decision to overturn Roe versus Wade and the federal right to an abortion. The future of abortion now rests with state lawmakers around the country. At least a dozen have banned the procedure. There are signs other rights protected by previous Supreme Court decisions, rights like same-sex marriage, for one, could be threatened. And if that weren't major enough, Americans' faith in the high court has changed dramatically as well. Christine, I want to know your reaction to the past week. And where do you think those who want to maintain access to abortion care are right now after this decision?
Well, I mean, you said that we've had about a week to process, which is true. I have to say that I'm still processing. I mean, we were given a warning that this decision would come down when the sort of first draft of the decision leaked earlier this spring. And yet I was still shocked when this ruling appeared and remain shocked that it actually happened. I'm, like many Americans, I think very conflicted about the issue of abortion. But one thing that I'm not conflicted about is my view of the Supreme Court right now. I think that this decision and also the discussion of, you know, the potential overturning of, exactly as you said, cases like Obergefell has really decimated the American public's trust in the institution. I mean, it was already low. Last year's polling said something like 36% of Americans, according to Pew, had confidence in the Supreme Court. And now that's dropped to 25%. And it seems like it's only downhill from here.
Yeah. So the president said that he supports changing Senate filibuster rules for the purposes of codifying Roe and also for voting rights. Sarah, what do you make of that? Do you think that politicizes this issue in a way that, I don't know if it's possible to politicize it anymore, but what's your reaction to the president who's been very wary to support changing the filibuster, who himself is a creature of the Senate and its very traditional ways, that he's willing to do that now?
Oh, I mean, I don't think that he's particularly wary of it at all, because he knows that it won't happen. So he can now say whatever he wants about it. You're right, this isn't even the first time he's done it this year. He said it about Voting Rights Act, knowing that Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema, potentially even Bob Casey, several Democratic senators weren't going to support blowing up the filibuster at this point. So now he just gets a freebie. Anytime there's something politically that he doesn't want to do executive action on, whether he can or can't is a separate question, now he can just say he supports blowing up the filibuster because he knows it won't happen. I do want to talk about one thing that you mentioned in your opening to Christine, which is you said the procedure had been banned in about a dozen states, but that's not quite accurate. You know, for instance, this case was about Mississippi's 15-week ban on abortion. Well, before that, it had simply been a viability line under Roe, so it had been about 24 weeks. So you've moved the line from 24 weeks to 15 weeks. That's what, for instance, the state of Florida has under a very conservative governor, Ron DeSantis. I think that my concern is not about the states where there's now a 15-week ban, for instance. That matches with the vast majority of countries in the world, and certainly the vast majority in Europe, for instance. I'm more concerned about the sort of rush to the base that I think we're going to see on both sides, at least in the short term on this issue, because for 50 years, people got to say and talk about whatever they wanted, knowing that they wouldn't actually have to have their legislation affect real people's lives. So you have poorly drafted laws like the one in Missouri, where they tried, they said, to make the removal of ectopic pregnancies more safe. But in reality, what they accidentally did was probably ban the removal of ectopic pregnancies where a fetus is implanted somewhere other than the uterus, non-viable child. You know, they're touching on the constitutional right to travel by saying that some states are going to try to ban women leaving a state where abortion is not allowed if they go to a state where it is allowed.
Well, but before we dive into state by state, essentially, I want to push back a little bit because the idea, yes, there may not be an actual ban, but what we have already seen, and I think what a lot of folks who wanted Roe overturned wanted, is the fact that abortion is largely unavailable to people without means to travel in many of these places. Even before
but
this
what
law
about
in Missouri
15
were,
weeks?
Let me finish my point. Even before this law in Missouri went into effect, there was only one provider of abortion care in the entire state of Missouri, and that was all the way to the eastern part of the state in St. Louis. Most people who don't, even if they have means, they would have to travel hundreds of miles to access it. Medical schools are not even prioritizing teaching new doctors on how to do these procedures because of the consistent state-level attack on this. So it's largely out of reach to people who don't have the means to travel. Whether you call it a ban or not, that's the reality for people who are seeking this care.
But what you've talked about is stuff that happened before last week. So that's not really overturning Roe. And my second point would be, if 94% of abortions are happening before 15 weeks, then I just don't know that moving the line from 24 weeks to 15 weeks is as earth-shattering as I think you're making it sound by saying last week abortion was allowed and this week it's banned, when in fact it's a little more nuanced than that.
Christine, I want to talk a little bit about the response from Democrats, the response to this ruling, and the response to what happens now. There's some reporting that there's a bit of hand-wringing within the White House about whether to act in an executive way for fear that that could isolate some voters or turn off some voters. Then there's also those like Elizabeth Warren who say that this is the time for Democrats to fight for everything, not only fight for a codification of Roe, but to fight for a host of other broad rights. What do you think the Democrats do now, and what is the best path forward?
Well, first, to tack back to this previous debate, I do think that the response for a lot of women and men, frankly, is fear. In states where abortion is, yes, if not, you know, completely legal, much harder to access, there is confusion about what the future will look like. There are women who had abortions planned who will not be able to get them now that their trigger laws have gone into position after the overturning of Roe. So I think there's a heavy emotional valence of confusion and betrayal. As to the White House wringing its hands, I honestly have to laugh mockingly, I suppose, at that argument. The idea that the White House doesn't want to do anything because it could endanger some chances in November. What do they think is actually going to happen in November? Do they not realize that Democrats are uniformly almost kind of enraged at them for letting this happen in the first place? And for the White House and, frankly, the Democratic establishment that does, however tenuously, have a majority in power right now to seem so, frankly, useless in the face of these changes. I think that actually it would be riskier for Democratic prospects for the White House to not do anything than it would to do something, really anything, just to make it seem like they're alive in there.
Yeah. So I want to talk, Christine, about the court itself and the implications about the court as an institution. I was having a conversation with some friends of mine, all of whom are on the left, and they found it, they thought they would celebrate the first Black woman to take the oath as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court would be so celebratory, but they feel so beaten down by the court as an institution that they almost send their sympathies to Justice Jackson as opposed to their congratulations. What do you think the standing is of the court after decisions like the EPA and Dobbs that overturned Roe v. Wade?
Yeah, it must be an odd feeling for her, for Judge Brown. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of lost confidence in the court. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, public support, public trust in the courts has been low for a while. But I think that these rulings are seen as politicized in a very real way, and have also highlighted how the politicization of appointments to the court, the polarization of court appointees, the number of appointees who joined the court without majority support from the U.S., from the American people, have really changed what decisions come out and, you know, how they're seen by the American public. There are cracks in the Supreme Court's legitimacy, from the American people and even from other justices on the court, especially justices who are perceived as being left-leaning. And it's just hard for me to imagine how the court recovers some of its stature. There are also, of course, underlying questions of what the court is supposed to be, you know, whether it is in fact supposed to represent the will of the American people. I think the real argument, of course, is that it is supposed to be an anti-majoritarian institution, not subject to public whims in the same way that the executive branch and the legislative branch are. That was a norm, but we aren't really living in a time of norms right now, unfortunately. We're living in, you know, an era of power, actually. And that is being reflected in the court. And that's what people are thinking and feeling.
Sarah, is there a sense that for those who have been pushing, the anti-abortion activists that have been pushing for Roe v. Wade to be overturned for decades, and the conservatives that support them might be the dog that caught the car, in that if this goes further and rolls back other rights, rights that have broad support in this country, like same-sex marriage, and if the court is just seen as a barefaced partisan institution, that the backlash could be not worth the victory?
So first, you know, there's the sort of legal argument about why the reasoning in Justice Alito's opinion could apply to something like same-sex marriage. And then you have Justice Thomas saying he thinks they should revisit that legal reasoning on what's called substantive due process. But from a just realistic standpoint, Justice Kavanaugh, who is in the majority more than any other justice, he is the swing vote on the court, he said no to that. He said those opinions, Obergefell, Griswold on contraception, Lawrence on same-sex relationships, he said those are not in doubt. So just realistically, the court isn't going to take them. They're not going to overturn them. It's just not happening. As far as the legitimacy of the court, I do want to add another point here, which is we have seen those on the right, particularly Trump followers, obviously undermine the legitimacy of our elections for political gain. And we have said that that is a threat to democracy, rightly so, because it is. That is how, you know, that is our birthright, is a self-governing republic. But I also see people undermining the legitimacy of the Supreme Court for political ends as well. It was happening long before Dobbs, of if the Supreme Court doesn't rule our way, then it is an illegitimate institution. That's not different from saying if the election doesn't go our way, then it's an illegitimate election. And so I am concerned about that from sort of a democratic norm standpoint. And by the way, it's not the first time in history. Don't forget that when Justice Jackson didn't like when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of an Indian tribe in Georgia, well, it might be apocryphal that he actually said it, but he certainly acted this way. He said, Justice Marshall has made him his opinion. Now let him enforce it. That led to the Trail of Tears. So the idea of undermining, nullifying the Supreme Court's opinions has a terrible history in this country. And I hope that people will think twice as they sort of keep saying, well, this court's pointless now. It's just politicized. You know, we didn't say that when Roe came out, and we didn't say that was a political decision. So it's hard for me to accept that the court is simply illegitimate when people don't like the outcome. And I think, again, when we talk about what other opinions might be in jeopardy, it is important to separate out sort of this intellectual academic conversation on substantive due process under the 14th Amendment after 1868 from realistically, Justice Alito said those opinions are not in question here. Justice Kavanaugh said not in doubt. Justice Roberts clearly on that side. That's six votes right there. And we didn't even hear from Justice Gorsuch or Justice Barrett.
Well, let me push back just a little bit about the fear-mongering. I take Justice Thomas at his word, and he, as you pointed out, said that they are on the table. I think we can ask ourselves whether we want to take the word of Justice Kavanaugh, or perhaps we
Absolutely.
Can ask Senator Collins and Senator, and other senators who said they believed what he said in their chambers and in his testimony. And finally, I think there's a big, big difference between disagreeing with what the Supreme Court does and saying that its legitimacy is in question. When I was in law school, I would read opinions that were written by perhaps one of the most conservative justices in the court's history, Antonin Scalia. And I might disagree with it, but I understood the basis of his reasoning. And I could see that at least up to a certain point in his tenure, he was consistent. It's an entirely different thing when the court on one hand says, no, we cannot let the states decide whether they can implement gun regulations, even though the words well regulated are right there in the Constitution. But no, we must leave it to the states when it comes to protecting a liberty right, when the word liberty also applies in the Constitution. That feels like picking and choosing to me, and I think that's one of the court's problems. So I've been talking with Sarah Isger and Christine Emba. We'll be back with both of them to talk about the January 6th committee's latest star witness. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, columnist for the Boston Globe. And on the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer at the Dispatch. And on the left, we're joined by Christine Emba, columnist and editor at the Washington Post. A surprise hearing held by the House Select Committee on January 6th brought us a new and very different messenger in the mounting case against Trump, Cassidy Hutchinson. She's the top aide to former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, poised and brutal and under oath. Hutchinson revealed how Trump not only knew the crowd on January 6th had weapons, he encouraged security to eliminate the metal detectors to allow those carrying them into the rally. According to Hutchinson, Trump was literally quoted as saying, "I don't effing care that they have weapons. Let my people in." She said he tried to join the mob at the Capitol, lurching even at Secret Service when they told him no. That's a claim that the Secret Service has denied. But, Christine, she was very clear about what perhaps liability former President Trump could face just based on the fact that he knew the crowd to be armed and he sent them to the Capitol anyway. Do you think that this is a smoking gun, Christine?
You know, it's hard to call anything a smoking gun at this moment, because it seems pretty clear that, you know, Republicans will never believe that Donald Trump committed a crime. That said, they might be willing to, you know, sort of turn the page in 2024 and be persuaded that he is not the horse that they want to back. But for those who are actually watching the committee hearings, for those who actually do care about the outcome of this decision, even if it does not result in criminal charges, Hutchinson's testimony was a firework, frankly. Must-watch hearing television, if such a thing can be said. Just her descriptions of the events that day, regardless of what sort of criminal liabilities they pretend, were so damning to the understanding of a president who believes in democracy, believes in the rule of law, even cares about the life of his own vice president. I mean, there was a statement that she made where Trump agreed that Mike Pence deserved to be hung and wasn't going to do anything about it and thought that, you know, the marchers should go to the Capitol and do that anyway. It was shocking in that it showed a sort of a level of depravity that any reasonable American should be frightened by. Of course, do we have enough reasonable Americans who are paying attention at this moment? That remains to be seen.
So, Sarah, to you, what was your reaction to her testimony, A, in the sense that Christine was talking about, as an American, feeling these details as laid out by somebody who was in the room, but also as someone who is an alum of the Justice Department? I have to say, I was watching this testimony with federal statute language in front of me for things like incitement of an insurrection or seditious conspiracy. What do you think this means on both fronts here?
So, look, this is a 25-year-old assistant who just testified with incredible poise and detail. I think, unfortunately, politically, the January 6th committee has left her in a very vulnerable position. You know, their credibility is staked on the fact that even though they don't have Republicans who disagree with their narrative on the committee, and understandably so, and I think we've gone into the history of that in past podcasts, that they're going to be scrupulous and fact-based in the witness testimony from these Trump officials. But they allowed her to testify at the last minute with 24 hours notice. It now appears that they didn't go and check some of the testimony that they knew she would give with the people who could corroborate it, like the Secret Service. And so some of the things she said we know are mistakes that, again, don't go to the heart of what she was testifying about, but could undermine the committee's credibility if they're presenting these witnesses with no cross-examination and the witnesses are saying things that are sort of easy and wrong. I'll give one example, which is, you know, she said the president was traveling in the Beast, quote unquote, that day. Well, they were showing video. The president was in an SUV. The Beast is this limousine that has a screen that would prevent him from reaching the steering wheel. And so just having things like that wrong and not having that adversarial process to sort of suss out the truth, I think undermines the committee's credibility moving forward in a really unfortunate way at this point. Look, on the incitement question, I don't think we're anywhere close to meeting the statutory or legal standard for incitement for the president. Because he has already said publicly he was trying to go to the Capitol that day. The thing that she added was that he knew that some of those people weren't going through the mags, although I think it will turn out that they did go through the mags. He was saying, send them to the Capitol. That's still nowhere close to the incitement level. However, I think that they have a huge problem on the fraud question, on the slate of electors that they knew hadn't been sent in by any state, but John Eastman, potentially Jeff Clark, were sending in that quote-unquote slate of electors to Congress, to the National Archives fraudulently. That's a felony. I think some of what went on in Georgia that they're investigating, that could meet the statutory definition. So even though I don't think we're anywhere close in the incitement realm, I just want to be clear, I think there's other avenues where, like, we're already past the line.
I also just have to say, you know, jumping in with there are questions about the Beast versus a limo versus an SUV. The fact that we are even having a discussion about whether it was possible that the president lunged forward in a vehicle and maybe almost throttled a Secret Service agent, like, that is an indelible image. And the fact that we even have to discuss something like that, I think, has an impact on what President Trump could do, what his role in public life could be moving forward. I think just what that testimony brought to light is important for forming an image of what happened in the American mind going forward, regardless of what charges in the end end up being brought.
But this is the difference between the evidence you must accept versus the evidence you can accept. You know, if you already don't like the president and someone says he did something outrageous, like, you know, there's ketchup on the walls, and you're like, can I accept that? Yeah. But then when it's evidence that would exonerate him, you're like, must I accept that? No, maybe that person's credibility has been questioned. And that's what I think we need to approach when it comes to the January 6th committee is erasing that line between can accept and must accept.
I think it's important to point out here on the idea of what evidence the committee may or may not have is that they have interviewed hundreds of people under oath. They have an astronomical amount of documentary evidence. And in that instance, Ms. Hutchinson was testifying as to what she was told, unlike the ketchup on the wall, which she saw with her own eyes. So I think it's important that we don't know everything that the committee knows yet, and that the committee themselves, and I agree with this, encourages everyone with direct knowledge to cooperate, including Pat Cipollone, who they have now subpoenaed. So, Christine, I want to ask you about this. One thing that I thought was really important that was underscored is the fact that so many folks involved in this, including Hutchinson's former boss, Mark Meadows, asked Trump for a pardon. What does that say to you?
Well, nothing good. I mean, that's all that.
You took the words out of my mouth. Nothing good.
It doesn't look good for them. Let's just say that.
What about also, at the end of this week's testimony, that Vice Chair Liz Cheney pointed out and displayed some messages that some witnesses have received that, again, taking out my good old federal statutes, look like they could amount to witness intimidation and the subsequent reporting that Ms. Hutchinson was one of the witnesses that received those messages, reminding her that the big guy is watching what she says. Sarah, what does that mean to you?
I found that really fascinating because, like you, I thought that those messages, you know, they're ambiguous, but the way that a mob boss is ambiguous, right? Be a real shame if something happened to that building, right? And I think that it's, you know, you're a lawyer. The number one thing you would ever say to a potential criminal defendant is do not ever contact any witness that they could be talking to. And this is why. Again, I think there is more legal jeopardy on the fraud case, on the Georgia case, because it is hard to do these ambiguous mob boss style statements. But they are acting like idiots, whoever sent those. And by the way, it's interesting that they've kept it anonymous who actually sent those messages. I'm hoping that that was sort of a teaser, that the committee has done this before, where they sort of at the end tease something they'll cover in the next committee hearing. It makes for good TV, but it's frustrating as a lawyer because it does matter who sent those. Does that person actually have the access and authority to speak on behalf of somebody who could be in legal jeopardy?
So, Christine, bigger picture from what we've seen from this committee so far, including the latest really compelling testimony, there are two audiences. One is the American people. The other is the DOJ and Merrick Garland. What case do you think the committee has made so far, and what do you think they still need to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you guys clearly can both speak to the legal case more closely than I can, as I'm not a trained lawyer, but I am really interested in what effect this case is having on the American people. As you mentioned, Sarah, it is theatrical. They do love ending on a cliffhanger and with dropping these sort of bombshells at the end. And again, whether or not, you know, they turn into sort of legal fodder for sort of actual crimes and prosecutions, they do leave an image. They do leave sort of a stench in the mind of people, who are watching these proceedings, a sort of understanding or sense that whatever happened here was not good, was not up to the standards of what we want for a president, was in some sense dangerous to our democracy. You know, there was the fear at the beginning of these hearings and, you know, still throughout, that they would be, you know, seen as partisan, only watched by sort of committed political Democrats and wouldn't have much of an effect. Fox News has not even, you know, carried most of them. But if you look at polling, it does seem that people are watching. that the American public is, you know, sort of being affected by this case. Something like, I think in recent polling, 60% of Americans believe that either a crime was committed or, you know, just generally that what happened on January 6th was wrong and President Trump is in the wrong. And that includes, I think, 20% of Republicans. And in this latest testimony, even Fox News actually, you know, mentioned on its homepage that Hutchinson had testified and what she said. So this sort of messaging that President Trump is maybe not fit to be president again is still getting out there into the public eye. And whatever happens criminally, I do think that that is important in at least setting or hopefully resetting just sort of the very, very basic norm that, you know, trying to stage an insurrection and overthrow an election is not good, actually, and that we are against that. So a very low bar. But I think that it might actually be having an impact.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. And we've reached that time, once again, for our famed left, right, and center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Christine Emba, what is on your mind?
Well, I am ranting against the just absolute limpness of the Democratic Party in this moment. And really, for a while now, the response to Dobbs was an encouragement to vote in November. You know, why? To what end? There was a moment shared widely on social media where Dana Bash on CNN asked Kamala Harris what to say to Democratic voters who want the Democrat-dominated government to do something, anything in the face of these changes. And her response was, do what? What has the Democratic Party been doing all these years? We've seen now in the outcome of these Supreme Court cases and in legislation that conservatives have been, frankly, vicious and strategic, and Democrats are shrugging and looking a bit sad in every instance. And this week's decisions further drive that home. In gun regulation, abortion policy, the Supreme Court, anything useful, it feels like the Democratic Party has just lay around waiting to be steamrolled, often out of fear of offense or being divisive, when in fact we are already divided. They're reliant on norms, norms that unfortunately no one else in our political system is.
All right, Sarah Isger, what's your rant?
Well, people may not know this, but actually, I am the biggest Christine Emba fan, and we are friends, in fact, in real life, and maybe there should be more of those friendships, but that's not my rant, actually. My rant is that when we talk about the Me Too era, we talk about it in the past tense, and I find that really frustrating because there is so much left to work out about our sex culture in this country. And Christine's book called Rethinking Sex, A Provocation should be headline news every day from here for the next 6 months. We should be talking about nothing else because it is about how our sex culture has undermined women, how having consent is the only bar, is leading to bad sex, and bad sexual relationships. Christine's book is brilliant, and it is exactly the next step that the Me Too movement needs. It is the thing that I recommend most to people right now about our cultural moment.
For my rant, I have what isn't really a rant. It is a statement of fact, and that is that this will be the last time I am guest hosting Left, Right, and Center. I think it is an amazing show. I will continue to be a listener, and it has been a pleasure to work with some of the most amazing journalists who put this show on. That has been a pleasure, and also to talk with all of our guests, including our guests today. But for me, the fact that as the guest host, I must represent the center. And for purposes of that show, I understand what that means. That means the person who challenges both sides, both of the other guests, engages with them, but also gives their perspective. And I understand that's different from what it means to be a part of the political center. And although I am not a registered Democrat or Republican, I haven't been registered in any party for a long time, as a journalist whose job it is to see the state of the country clearly, to me, it seems that the biggest threat to the safety and security and the rights of Americans and democracy itself is coming from one side. And I cannot, in good conscience, be in any role where that can even be mistaken that I am making an equivalence there. And so for that reason, I cannot call myself a center, and I think I would be doing a disservice to our listeners if I continue to do that. So I would continue to support the show. I will listen. I think you should too. And I really am grateful for the opportunity to host. But this will be the last time. And that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Sarah Isger, Christine Emba, and Jonathan Adler. Left, Right, and Center is produced by the amazing Sarah Singer Schiff. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Thanks for joining us. And tune in next week, as I will, for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
From PRX.